Great. Well, thank you, everyone. As Roger posted in the chat, we'd like to welcome you to the first conference call of RF102, Get to Know Your Community. And I'd like to acknowledge that I'm hosting this call from the traditional territory of the Kwamlyn Dun First Nation and Ton Kwachin Council. Our agenda for today will be similar to most of our calls. We'll start with some introductions, look at this week's content, and then share some of our thoughts about the prompts that you may have found on slide number 14. So I'd like to start with a round of introductions, and I also have a question for you to ask as you're introducing yourself. When you introduce yourself, because when we have new people on the call, it's nice to say who you are, what you do, and what community you're calling from. That would be super helpful. I'd also like it if you could also share a reason why, as a recreation leader, you might want to get to know your community better. So what I'll do is we're going to go in order of, we're going to start with the west and go south and east and north and back to the west. So I've got Whitehorse first, then Fort Liard, then Baker Lake, and then over to Faro afterwards. So that way we'll go, I'm going to start with Roger. I'm going to put him on the spot and ask him to introduce himself first. Then we'll go to Maxime, then Nathan, then Megan, and then Kelly. So over to you, Roger.
Hello. Good morning, everybody. My name is Roger, and I'm really excited to be doing my instructor development right now. One reason why I think it's important to know your communities is we are always looking for funding, and different funding depends on what kind of programs you're running. And to know that, you need to know your community.
Awesome. Thanks, Roger. Maxime, could you introduce yourself next?
Yeah, for sure. My name's Maxime. First of all, thank you for having me on the call and inviting me into this learning course. I'm really excited to be part of it for a couple of weeks. I'll quickly just mention I'm part of Communities Building Youth Futures UConn. So although I'm based in Whitehorse, we're trying to expand to communities as well. And one reason rec leaders need to know their community, I think understanding who lives in the community, like what their day-to-day lives are like and what their needs are, obviously is really important for improving recreation for that specific community because communities are all different from each other. Thanks.
Awesome. Thanks, Maxime. And I'm just wondering if you can just say what the Community Building Youth Futures is, because different people in different communities might be working with youth. And I know that there's also a project in NWT, which is where Nathan is. So maybe you could just share a little bit about that for everyone on the call.
Yeah, for sure. So Community Building Youth Futures, I'll just briefly mention. So there's a bunch of them throughout Canada. There's one in Yellowknife. We are the UConn one, and I know there's one in Northern Quebec as well. And yeah, it's about collective impact. So there's a lot of people working together, and we're a collective of young people and organizations and government workers, and we're basically trying to support young people, remove barriers for them, and it's really the like high school age into adulthood, like kind of that transition is the target. I'm happy to talk about it more if people have questions or you can reach out to me. But yeah, the gist of it is it's a collective and we're working towards building a UConn youth strategy kind of in the long run.
Thanks. And I think my understanding is the projects are different depending on where they are. So the one for NWT might be a little bit different than in the UConn, but they're fairly long projects, right? Like 4 to 5 years in length?
Yeah. So we're in year 2 of 5 now. And they're all very different from each other. They're very dependent on the community that is serving. So, yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you for sharing that. And there are other people on the call who am in the learning event who do work with youth, so I think it's important to understand what each of us are doing, so thanks. Nathan, let's go over to you since you're pretty far south in the general northern part of our three territories. So over to Fort Liard and Nathan.
Hi, my name is Nathan Wilson. I'm in Fort Lee Yard in the Northwest Territories. I've been working this position here for maybe 4 or 5 months now. And one thing that I think that recreation leaders would want to know for to better the community would be I can see that it might help with targeted programming, so that way you're not introducing events and programs that the community would have like no interest in whatsoever, or something that they would prefer over current programs, and that would just increase engagement and satisfaction with the community and the events.
That's great. Thanks, Nathan. And you mentioned like you moved from Iqaluit, right? So you probably had to take some mm-hmm. time when you started your position in Fort Lee Yard to really get to know, because it's a different community and every community across the North is so different.
Mm-hmm. Usually for the most part, soccer is like usually one of the main sports, and it's kind of the same here which as it was in the Iqaluit with that. For the other like small things, I shouldn't say small things, but for the other activities, boarding, like snowboarding is like big here in Fort Lee Yard, but then in Iqaluit, I think there's only like one or two youth that had snowboards, and they own them personally.
Yeah, so it's interesting to know that there's some things that a lot of communities have in common, and I think maybe Megan might be able to reflect on that for Nunavut as well. And then, mm-hmm. Those differences between the communities. So thanks, mm-hmm. thanks, Nathan. Let's move over to Baker Lake, where it's colder now. Over to you, Megan.
Yeah, hi. My name is Megan Hashi. I am a project coordinator with Sport and Recreation Nunavut, and I'm based out of Baker Lake. One reason recreation leaders may want to get to know their community better is because it goes back and forth. Like, it also allows the community to get to know you. So if you're not very familiar with the community you're working in or your position, then it's more likely that the community doesn't know anything about you either. Getting to know your community and reaching out to others and learning more about what's around you, it allows for networking and it builds trust between not only you and the community members, but you and other organizations as well, which would then make room for partnerships. So yeah, it just allows that relationship between you and the community you work in.
That's I really like how you explain that it's about relationship building, because there's lots of reasons for us just to get to know the community, but without that relationship, then you don't really get to know them, right? And those relationships take a long time, especially I think in small communities it takes a long time for people to sort of trust and build a relationship. I remember when I first moved to Watson Lake, after about a year, somebody said, you're okay, you stuck around. And that was 30 years ago, and that's really stuck with me. So thank you for explaining that, Megan. You did an awesome job of sharing that. Thank you. And then let's come all the way back over to the Yukon, to Farrow. Kelly, I'm not sure if you're able to unmute and just introduce yourself and share a reason why recreation leaders might want to get to know their community better.
Hi, I'm Kelly. I live in Farrow, and I'm a volunteer in the community. I think it's really, really important for us to build relationships and get to know people in our community, so then we know what age groups there are, what things people are interested in, so we can have successful events and we can put together recreational activities that where we're going to get more numbers and volume and have other people meet each other in the community as well.
Thanks, Kelly. That's really important. And it's good to hear a volunteer perspective, because I think it's just as important for people who are volunteering their time to have that sense of their community as well as people who are paid in their role too. So thank you. Thanks, everybody. Those are some really good reasons why you might want to get to know your community a little bit more. You know, I think what Megan said too is really important. Sometimes in the North, we have people who move into a community in a position or in a role, and that takes time to get to know your community, but so important to sort of reflect on where things are at and who's there. The other thing that I sometimes find is sometimes there's shifts or changes in communities. One of the biggest ones I can think of is when I first moved to the Yukon, Faro was a community of 2,000 people and the mine shut down. And now it's a very, very different community than what it was then. So, you know, I think part of revisiting who's who in your community and what drives your community, and as Megan said, the organizations and resources that support your community, I think that it's a dynamic process, so it's something that changes, and so it's good to come back to it and not always assume, oh, we've always done things that way, and that's why it's important. So let's take a couple of minutes just to go through this week's content, and I'm just going to begin with slide 4, if you happen to have the slides open, and if not, no big deal. As you can see, this learning event, which is RF-102, we're looking at ways to get to know your community. We're looking at some of the characteristics that we might want to consider in community recreation, and we're also going to look at some of the strategies that respond to your local community's characteristics and help make recreation more inclusive, accessible, and meaningful. So in order for recreation actually to make a difference in our communities, as slide 6 shows, it needs to be inclusive and welcoming, as barrier-free as possible, accessible, meaningful, relevant. And I think all of us are involved in community recreation because we believe in the power of recreation to support physical and mental health and also social and community well-being. But if you don't know the heart and soul of your community, if you don't know what really drives your community's values, you know, you can almost think of your community as a person. If you don't really know all of that, it's hard to make a difference in the lives of people and the quality of life in your community. So you might, as Nathan said, put programs out there that maybe don't, you know, people in your community don't respond to. So it is really important to get to know the heart and soul. So in this learning event, we're really looking at what drives your community so you can be more intentional in the way that you do recreation, whether it's in your individual community or across the communities that you work with. Slide 7 just gives you a little bit of a visual of how this learning event, RF-102, fits with the one we finished, which was RF-101, Recreation and Sports Systems, and then how it will fit with RF-103, which we do in May, which is Northern Recreation, Arts, Culture, and Sport. And so these three learning events together are designed sort of to help you look at recreation that's inclusive and relevant and figure out what works best in your community. So when you want to get to know a community better, you have to kind of figure out, first of all, what you want or what you need to know. And then you have to figure out how to get that information. And then often you might need to present that information. So Roger mentioned, you know, when you apply for funding, sometimes you need to be able to present information about your community in a way that other people can understand. You also need to know why some of the information that you've collected is important. So, you know, it might not matter that we have X number of salmon coming up our river, but it might matter that X number of people like to go fishing, for example, something like that. So if we think about facts and stats, so facts and statistics, they can help us understand our community. But in recreation, we want to go deeper and also get a good sense of core community values, traditions, and relationships. So this week we look at, it's all about the research room. So this week we're looking about facts and stats. And next week it's about the deeper part that sometimes is hard to put your finger on. So in this week you reviewed slides 9 to 12 and you went through activity 1. Slide 10 introduces demographics. And some of those, you guys are probably pretty familiar with things like age of people in your community, income, employment, ethnicity, family size. Those are things that sometimes are fairly easy to find off government websites or community profiles. Slides 11 and 12 introduce things like the physical environments and the built environments that you find in and around your community. So on slide 11, you might need to know things about your recreation facilities or about roads and transportation or what you have for other institutions like schools or different businesses. And that would also include, as Megan pointed out, like community groups as well. And if you look at slide number 12 is more about the natural environment. So, you know, if you think about what safety means to somebody in perhaps in Baker Lake or in Bugluktuk as compared to what safety might mean for us in Whitehorse, could be two very different things. So we have to also understand how our natural environment influences what we do with recreation as well. So a community profile, which is introduced on slide 13, is something that you can do, and you can show it in many different ways, but it often showcases some of the facts and stats about your community. It's probably pretty easy to create a profile that either sheds a really positive light on your community, or you could also pull out facts and stats that shed a really negative light. Like, I could say a lot of great things about Whitehorse with the trails, how active people are, but I could also pull out statistics about alcohol and drug use and hospital visits and things like that. So what we need to think about is which facts and stats are important, what you're using them for, and make sure that we're aware of all of them, but you also, I guess I'm not saying that you can manipulate them, but in a way you can. You can pull out the ones that that work for you, for what you need to paint. So I'm just going to pause here for a moment, and we're going to go around in our same circle. So I'm going to put Roger on the spot again, and I'll ask Roger to pop the question in the chat. So what I'd like to know is when might you or other recreation leaders prepare and or use a community profile? So when might you choose to gather that information, put it together into something that other people can understand and share it?
I think the first time I would do this is if I was in a new position to really get myself a bit of a basis to know where I'm working with, so I'm able to kind of ground myself and then create my programming from there.
Thanks, Roger. Maxine, how about you? Because you guys have a bit of a big project around youth in the territory. So
Hello? I can hear you. I think it might have been just been Caroline that dropped.
Yeah, I think Caroline's line cut out or something. Caroline or Roger, can you hear me?
We'll okay, Roger just.
Did they post in the chat?
Yeah, Roger posted me. He just said that Carolyn's going to get back on.
Okay. Good.
Sorry, he didn't say that she's going to get back on, but he said that she had disconnected and came on.
Okay. Northwest Tile is added again.
Yeah.
Hello, everybody. This is Caroline. Are you still on the call?
Yep.
Yes.
Okay. I don't know what happened. My phone just ended the call, so, and then it wouldn't let me reconnect. So now we're on Roger's call. I'm just going to start the call recording once more, so hang tight.
Okay.
Okay, so Roger's popped the chat in the, or the question in the chat again, and I think we got to Roger answering, and then I was asking Maxine to go next. So let's see if we can come back to our circle. And the question is, when might you or other recreation leaders prepare and or use a community profile? So over to you, Maxine, and you might want to apply it to like the broader community that you're working with, not just the specific geographic community.
Yeah, for sure. It's pretty complex because if we're looking at our community profile as the whole territory, the whole Yukon, then there's a lot of variety within it. And it's really important to, you know, to be aware of that and be aware of the differences, especially like in the Yukon, Whitehorse versus communities. Like services are, you know, when you do a community profile or you're looking at all the stats, it becomes obvious that all the services are in Whitehorse, everything's very centralized, and that can marginalize the community. So that's one reason it's important to know where the resources are so that you can support any underserved areas. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, that does. So what you're trying to do is you're trying to allocate resources more fairly where they're needed. And a community profile, whether it's one community or a series of communities or a larger community like a territory, can show perhaps where those gaps are, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Awesome. That's a good way of explaining it from a broader perspective. Nathan, for yourself, either yourself as a recreation leader or someone else, when do you think you might prepare and or use a community profile?
I would say during like funding applications and maybe if program facilitators ever like you know use that type of information. It could be for you know educational organizations. Like I'd seen some statistics about smoking in Fort Liard, and I think you know, there's probably some educational organization out there that would want to know that statistic to decide whether or not they'd want to come to VR to do like an anti-smoking campaign or you know that type of stuff. I could think about those things.
Yeah, I like that. So one of them is for you for your funding application, but the other one might be to generate support for priorities in your community.
Mm-hmm.
That's great, and I think that is so important to share with people who are coming into your community how things might be different. I was just speaking with Attila and Maria with Nunavut Table Tennis Association, and they're up in Kugluktuk. They've been there for 17 years, and they were telling me it's really challenging when they have coaches or facilitators come from outside the territory because they just don't understand the, you know, they come from Southern Ontario and they don't understand how things are different. So, you know, a community profile can help with that as well as what I think that's what you're saying too, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Just to kind of either help the facilitators like better understand like who and what they're working with, or yeah, you know, let them decide like if their program would be needed, like kind of like I said for the smoking thing, but I'd assume in most communities, you know, we need smoking campaigns and stuff like that.
That's a great example. Thank you so much. Megan, how about from your perspective, either yourself in sort of past roles that you fill, because you've had a lot of different roles in recreation and sport, or in your current role? When might you want to need to prepare or use a community profile?
One reason you may need to use or prepare a community profile is for reporting purposes. So whether that's for, as they mentioned, funding applications or reporting on the success of a program, whether it's for your job or for community awareness, the community profile allows you to justify what has been done and provide reasoning for what could be done in the future.
Yes, I really like that reporting purposes. I had this vision in my head as you were talking. I,
I often say, wow, we had 3 people participate. We're so excited. And if you say that to somebody from outside, they might think that you're crazy, because why are you happy about only 3 people? But then they don't know that maybe you only have 15 kids in your community or 15 elders. And so that 3 of those participating is like 20%. So it's actually pretty good. So that's a really good way of explaining it. And especially from a government perspective, when your funders, knowing how each community is different and the population breakdown in a community and all those sorts of things. So thank you for explaining that, Megan. Kelly, how about from your perspective, which is different as a volunteer, when do you think it might be helpful to prepare and or use a community profile?
So I'm thinking of a different perspective. I was kind of thinking about if you're already into a role and have a position in just for example, at the rec center, because we've talked about how much Faro has changed. Just even the past year and a half that I've been here, we've seen a lot more, a lot of growing families moving into Faro. So I was kind of thinking, what if it was in a community that is constantly changing, what if there was a community profile review once a year, say in the fall, when things are kind of ramping up again, kind of checking into things and seeing who you have in the community and what you might want to change or what you can offer as a new program.
Yeah, I think that's really important, because, you know, if you sort of go on the assumption that 5 years ago we had, you know, almost 15% of our population was kids under the age of 12, and then now you find out it's 25, then your priorities around how you address things might change. Thanks for sharing that, Kelly. Roger, do you have anything to add to that, or how does that sound? Good?
Well, Roger's got his thumbs up. Okay. I just wanted to give him the opportunity. So,
you know, I think you guys touched on all the things that I kind of had in mind. I think the only other one that sometimes when a community profile can be helpful is if, and it's sort of in line with what most of you have said, but sometimes you need to go to chief and council, mayor and council, to your hamlet SAO, and you have to justify why you're asking for something. So if, you know, if your ask is for more money to do after school programs, for example, then having the community profile that shows why that ask is so important can be really helpful. So that might be another reason as well. So when you prepare a community profile, you're collecting information that you find usually in things like community profiles, in different plans, you could use maps as well, in reports, and in documents. And mostly I think these are available on government sources. So if you took a look in Activity 1, you would see that, for example, Nunavut has community profiles for each community, and they're really actually excellent community profiles. And they have other profiles in the Nunavut Integrated Community Sustainability Plans. I've also added a link for the Nunavut Bureau of Statistics. For NWT, I had a hard time finding other sources. So, Nathan, if you know of anywhere other than the NWT Bureau of Statistics, feel free to share that with me and I'll add it. And then in the Yukon, we have some community profiles that are getting a little older now. I noticed they were last updated in 2014, so that is older. We have our Yukon First Nations site, the Bureau of Stats, and we have this new open data portal, but the challenge with that one is it doesn't include sport and recreation. So that makes it a little bit more challenging. And then if you're looking for other open sources, there's some neat maps out there. There's a native land map that's a worldwide one. There's the Inuit Nunangat map and the First Nation Profiles interactive map. So that those are some other sources that you can actually use. And in Activity 1, I've given you some questions that you can just start with and answer. And I noticed Gordon did his post already for his RLA, and he actually answered every single one of these questions about his community. I'm not expecting you guys to do that at all, so I just wanted to point that out, that the questions are there just as some ideas about things that you may want to include in a community profile. So it's really important to make sure that we're using statistics and facts about our community. But because our communities are small, it's also really important to learn about our communities informally. And this goes back to what Megan said about building relationships. So I can sit there and go on a website and find out, you know, how many children are in Tugaruk under the age of 12. And I just found that out from talking to the SAO, actually. But, you know, I can go and find those numbers out, but numbers are only good so far. So as Megan mentioned, it's the relationships that we need to build. So we need to also find ways to learn about our communities more informally. So often you might do this through a community gathering. You might do this through informal chats with people. You have some great conversations at either a grocery store or at the post office or something like that. And also just by watching people's patterns is another way. And so when you gather information informally, it helps build relationships, and it really, as Megan mentioned, builds the relationship two ways, like between you and your community, but also your community gets to know you as well. So the one challenge, and I just wanted to set the stage with one last question this week, the thing that we wanted to do when we're looking at working or getting to know our communities more informally is making sure that we collect information or gather information respectfully. And what that means could look like or could be different for each of you in your positions, and also different depending on the communities that you're working with. So I'm going to ask Roger to jump in first and share some ideas about how he feels he can gather information respectfully about communities. Then we'll go to Maxine, Nathan, Megan, and Kelly.
I think one of the best ways to be respectful is to let people know up front what you're planning to do with the information and where it's going, so that they have full information as to how much they want to share. There's going to be a big difference if it's going to the mayor and council versus to other particular boards, and folks have different levels of comfort.
Thanks, Roger. So it's respectful then to let people know what you're doing, why, and how that information is going to be used. Maxine, how about yourself? What do you think about how we can respectfully gather information?
I think there's a bunch of ways. I think this one is obvious, but with their consent, like making sure you're not actually just taking information that you're not allowed to take. And then maybe providing optional opportunities where people can share. And then asking for people's actual feedback to be a more of an authentic way to get information. Like, you're actually caring about their opinion rather than just collecting their data. You're trying to get their voice in there too.
Yeah, do you have an example of the last one? Of something when you would have sort of collected feedback so that you can hear the opinions to get to know your community better?
Yeah, I mean, we've done a lot of research amongst young people and how they feel about systems and what they feel, could be improved. So, for example, rather than just collecting, like, their age and what school they go to or, you know, their gender, it's actually, like, asking them, what do you think are the important issues and, like, how can we solve them? What are your ideas? So
you value their knowledge is just as important as your own knowledge, right? So they're the ones that are living those experiences. They're the ones that are living in their community and experiencing things. So, you know, taking the time, I guess, to hear about it from their side, their perspective.
Yeah, exactly. It's like their knowledge is part of the data. It's not just their demographic.
Great, thank you. Nathan, how about yourself? How, if you wanted to get information from your community, what are some of the ways that you might do it so that it was, you know, respectful? And I'm not implying that we wouldn't be respectful. I just know that there's mm-hmm. different ways of showing that respect in different communities.
Mm-hmm. I'd say I'd probably, kind of like what Roger said, one of the things I do is I'd like kind of provide proper justification for gathering that data. And I'd try to, like, you know, not touch too sensitive topics. Like, you know, I'm not professionally trained in interacting people with, you know, with sensitive subjects and stuff like that. Or, you know, I wouldn't want to ask anything too invasive, like, you know, personally. But, yeah, I'd just say as long as proper justification and, like, you know, reasoning was provided and it wasn't too sensitive, I think for the most part it would be all right.
Yeah, I really appreciate you sharing that about sensitive topics, because it is easy, you know, especially over the last 2 years, a lot of sensitive topics have bubbled up even further, right, because people are tired of being in isolation and tired of not being with family and friends and not being able to do things that they're used to do. So I think some of those things are even more apparent. But, you know, recognizing, as you said, as recreation leaders, we're not trained counselors, and we have to be cautious about letting those issues surface, because then what do we do with them, right? Like, we can't have somebody sort of disclosing or sharing things and then we're not able to support them through that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks a lot, Nathan. Megan, how about from your perspective, you know, in your experiences, how do you see information is gathered respectfully, or what are some of the key ways that we can demonstrate respect when we're gathering information?
I think one of the more, like, basic ways is ensuring that, so whether you're collecting information or providing options for feedback, I think it's important to ensure the information is available in different languages. So, like, when we're in our northern communities, a lot of the people living here, their first language isn't English. Like, it might be Inuktitut or Inuktun or Inuktun. So it's important that that information is available to them, even if they don't just speak English.
Yeah, and sometimes even if they can share information back in English, at least providing the scope or the instructions or your questions in their language might help them be able to express themselves in a way that we can understand. Well, I should say I, because I don't speak, so that might be helpful as well. And Megan, from your experience, is there anything about working with elders in ways, like, if we wanted to approach an elder and sort of perhaps get some, have them share their, some experiences that they've had or their perspectives on recreation, are there any things that from an Inuit cultural perspective are respectful as far as working with elders or community?
I think one of the things from my experience is meeting them where they're at or where they're most comfortable. So you wouldn't really ask a group of elders to go somewhere where they don't typically meet. So, like, in our community, one of the more regular places is community hall. So if you wanted to have a meeting with elders, you would invite them there rather than a building that they've never been to or a building that isn't relevant to them and their lives. Or even going into their homes. So if you're interviewing an elder, they'll often invite you into their home because it's easier for them rather than going around town if they're, like, limited or have disabilities or stuff like that.
Yeah, and how about if you're inviting them to the hall? Is it, like, I know in the Yukon, the practice of having food, right? So bringing people together and then there's some food at the same time. Is that similar in Nunavut as well?
Yeah, I think so. Like, food, refreshments, you usually give them something like that. A lot of people also offer them rides because not everyone has their own vehicle. So, like, just ensuring that wherever you are, it's, like, inclusive and accessible and they're comfortable being there.
Awesome. Thank you. I'm going to go to Kelly, and then I wouldn't mind coming back to this and Nathan asking you how, in your experience, this is different as well. So, because I think we have differences across our three territories, and it's interesting to look at that. So let's go to Kelly first, though. Kelly, What are some of the ways, or how can you gather information respectfully about your community, or how can we, in general, be respectful in our communities when we gather information?
I think being fully transparent, open and honest about how the information will be used and what information will be used, so people understand how that information, how their personal information will be out there.
Yeah, and to make sure that we also actually just do that and don't do more, right? Yeah, sometimes it's easy to tell somebody's story to someone else when they, you know, disagreed to share it with the staff, for example. So I think that that can be challenging. Anything else to add to that, Kelly?
No.
Okay, and I think for myself, I'm going to speak from a UConn perspective, and then I'm wondering if we can go back to NWT and perhaps Nunavut, if Megan has anything else to add at the end. One of the things that I've learned from working with First Nations communities in the Yukon is that any information that I gather isn't my information, and it's not, I think that speaks to what you guys are saying here about making sure that knowledge is owned, making sure that people know how they're going to use it. But it took me a bit of a shift in my thinking to really understand that even though people were sharing their stories, it was their stories and it was their knowledge. And so acting in a way that it respects that is really important. And then I think, as I mentioned, the other piece is also for us in the Yukon knowing the difference between the protocols in each community. So I often find we have 14 different First Nations in the Yukon. I sometimes get confused about, you know, am I supposed to provide a gift? Am I supposed to provide an honorarium? Do I need to do a prayer if we're having a gathering at the beginning? Land acknowledgements is another one. Like, it's, you know, it's something that's accepted here. But I remember asking some youth ambassadors in Nunavut about it, and they weren't quite sure because they said, well, it's our land. So it's interesting to think about that from the different territorial perspective. So I'm just wondering, Maxime or Roger or Kelly, do you have anything else to add from a UConn perspective? And then I'm going to ask Nathan and Megan if there's anything else to share. Roger's got his thumbs up. Maxime, any other comments from what you've learned about from a UConn perspective?
Nothing really comes to mind other than just the diversity of different First Nations and areas and languages. Like, you need to know what context you're in.
Yeah, and sometimes you have to ask to find out, right?
Yes, for sure.
Exactly. Kelly, any other thoughts about that from a UConn perspective? Because I think you've lived in both Whitehorse and Faro, right?
I've only lived in Faro, and I'm still, you know, even being here a year and a half, I'm still learning a lot. So I'm still learning. Nothing else to add.
Awesome. Nathan, do you mind if I put you on the spot and just ask you, you know, are there some sort of practices or protocols if you're doing something like a community gathering, like inviting elders to share perhaps some of their wisdom or perspectives with you? Or are there protocols in the communities that you've lived in or the other communities that you're familiar with in NWC around that?
The only thing that I could think of is that maybe... like, you know, with age, like, you know, you want to make sure that you have, like, their proper consent, and if they're, like, you know, underage, then you have their parental or the parents' consent as well, too. That's the only other thing that I can think of.
Well, that's a really good example. So it's not just thinking about perhaps how we show respect to elders, but how we respect children and youth, and also whether or not their parents want them to participate in perhaps a feedback or a session where we're gathering information. And Nathan, in your communities, is it a practice to give people an honorarium if they participate in a community gathering or a gift or anything like that?
It depends on the gathering, because I know in, like, you know, Christmas, like, usually with Christmas gatherings, they'll find ways to give out hampers and stuff like that. And same deal, it's usually just like small food for events and stuff like that. Like right now our kitchen's under renovation, so we can't do any like big cooking. So for the next meanwhile, probably until sometime next summer, like it's just gonna be prepackaged foods and stuff like that.
Right, which is probably easier with COVID going on.
Yeah.
It's time to renovate the kitchen. Thanks, Nathan. And Megan, I'm going to ask you one more question because it's a question that I asked, as I mentioned, the youth ambassadors. And when I, last year with the youth ambassador group, you know, I realized that every call I do an acknowledgement of traditional territory. And I did look up what the practice is for Inuit land, for Inuit territories, for Nunavut, and I'm just wondering, what I found was that it wasn't a practice. So I'm just wondering if you have any other perspectives on that or anything that you can shed light on what I've learned so far.
Yeah, so we don't typically do land acknowledgements. The Nunavut Agreement, like the political contract that made Nunavut into a territory, is essentially a modern day treaty. So we're all basically aware that we live here because it is our land. And so everything we do shows respect to our land, and we don't really acknowledge the previous camps and land bases there were, because, like, there's, of course, you could say there's different Inuit that came from different places, but we usually just identify ourselves as Inuit, and we're all kind of from Nunavut rather than different. Like, for First Nations, they have different bands or different reserves, but we just say we're in Nunavut. But alternatively, especially if an elder is hosting or opening things up, what they will do is either a prayer or the lighting of a pulla. And like others have said, this isn't really for everything. Like if it's just a community celebration, or like some sort of, meeting, they will do something like that. Like for ceremonies, they typically do the lighting of the kulla. It's just kind of like the opening, like the start of the event, basically.
So if somebody's coming into your community, then they, for like a community gathering, or maybe they're helping facilitate, you know, community recreation planning or something like that, then they just need to touch base with the person in the community to find out what's appropriate at that, for that type of gathering or meeting.
Yeah, pretty much. Like you might say, thank you, Sacred Lake, for having me, but besides that, usually the elders or the rec coordinator can determine whether anything else is needed.
Awesome. Thanks. So that's really interesting, because when I asked the youth ambassadors that question about land acknowledgements, they said, well, we don't do that, but we make sure that we welcome people. We offer them something to eat and sometimes a place to stay and things like that. So I think that that's really important for us in NWT and in Yukon to understand the differences from territory to territory. So thank you very much, everybody. I really appreciate your participation today. I just wanted to quickly touch on one point about the RLA, which stands for Required Learning Activity, that's due on Sunday. Please be aware that you don't have to make it really long. It's just asking you to share a couple of facts and stats about your community, and then to explain how these influence or should influence recreation in your community. And if your community is bigger, like Megan, if you want to think of all of Nunavut, you can, or if you want to think of Baker Lake, you can. There's Teresa from Pond Inlet has done a really good example. She just pulled out three different statistics and then gave three reasons or three explanations of how those influence recreation in her community. So I look forward to seeing that. Make sure you read each other's, because I think that it helps us understand the diversity that we have across the North when we sort of learn about each other's communities. And it also helps us understand how we can get to know our own community better.
So after I stop the call recording, I will stay on the line if you have any other questions. And otherwise, next week's conference call will be back on Thursday at our normal time on Thursday. And I'll just, so feel free to stay on the line if you have any questions, and I'll just get Roger to say goodbye too and tell me how to.
Thanks, everybody. It was really great to hear everybody's ideas today. I'm looking forward to next week.
Thanks, everybody. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, everyone.